Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Shelley Wade, and today we are talking about prohibition in Alaska, the history of alcohol control in our great state. My guests today are Bruce and Audrey Kelly, volunteers and members of the Cook Inlet Historical Society, Shirley Gifford, director for the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and Bob Beasley, enforcement supervisor for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Welcome to the show today, folks. We encourage you to share your stories, comments, and questions with us as we cover this fascinating topic on the history of alcohol control in Alaska. You can reach us by calling 550-8433 if you're in Anchorage. Outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. Or email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So we're going to dive right into just a little bit of history, and maybe I'll help us set the stage before we Audrey talks to us a little bit about the history prior to some legislation that was passed and some important laws regarding alcohol control. So in 1915, the Alaska legislature decided to ask Alaskans whether they wanted to ban the sale and manufacturing of liquor. And there was this big campaign against demon rum that reflected many of the same opinions gathering strength throughout the country. And then in 1918, big important time in our history, the Bone Dry Law Act was passed. This prohibited alcohol consumption and sale in Alaska. And this was 2 years prior to the passing of the 18th Amendment. So nationally, the whole nation went dry. So Audrey was going to share with us her perspective on how this movement started in Alaska. And Audrey, you've got an interesting perspective, kind of what was happening in terms of the women's movement as well.
Yes, this is Audrey. And I think the whole prohibition situation really began with women who had the greatest to lose from demon rum. In the in 1860s, 1870s, the Women's Christian Temperance Movement was founded, and a lot of people remember the name Carrie Nation from those early days. Well, women at that time, remember, their husbands controlled their money and their property. So if a woman was married to somebody who did like to drink and drank a lot, they were at risk as well as their children because of demon rum. Well, in Alaska, the members of the Women's Temperance Movement started meeting in Skagway, Alaska, from 1913 to 1915. And during those years, they actually drafted what they recommended the territorial legislature pass as the Alaska Bone Dry Act. And that led to that advisory vote that you had mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And it passed over 2-1 in favor of prohibiting alcohol. So it went to the federal government, and in 1918, the federal government actually passed Alaska Bone Dry Act for the entire state of Alaska. Prior to that, only certain localities had to have were prohibited from having alcohol within their town site. And Bruce has some things to say about that.
Well, there was one quick thing. That's great, Audrey. I have an interesting quote here from the governor of Alaska at the time in 1915, Governor John Strong, that says, "To the votes of women of Alaska may be ascribed by crystallization of public sentiment against the liquor traffic in the territory." So I think that puts an emphasis on your point that it really started with kind of the women's movement and the temperance movement.
But I'd like to add one other thing. Judge Wickersham, he had also something to say about this, and his feeling was if the saloons throughout the territory had not been so rough and rowdy and disreputable, it's possible so many women wouldn't have been for prohibition.
Bruce, so you had something to add on just the establishment of Anchorage at the time and what was happening in Anchorage.
Bruce here. Anchorage was a unique in a sense because it was a government set up town for the establishment of the railroad. And it was a dry town upon its conception. So even prior to the Bone Dry Act, the actual town site of Anchorage was dry. And that was decreed by the President of the United States and through the Congress back in Washington, D.C. No liquor was sold in the town site or in a five-mile strip on either side of the railroad right away. And so, like all frontier kind of towns, bootlegging became a science. In the winter, it came in by hand sleds, dog teams, over trails, and in the summer, it came in boats. There were five-gallon cans stacked in bales of hay and in tomato cans that were not tomatoes. Boats would land at Bootlegger's Cove, which is just near the town site, but it's unique in that it was out of sight of the actual town site around the curve there. So the boats would come in there, and then they would take the alcohol off and get and smuggle it into the town site. And the town site consisted of land up until about what is now called 9th Avenue. And on 10th Avenue, it was outside the town site, so these vices, the three evils, as they were called in those days, and that was alcohol, gambling, and prostitution, could flourish in that area. So once the alcohol found its way into the line, then it was pretty much safe from prosecution. The law enforcement people didn't really come around there too much. And it was easy to find the line in those days. There was a whole bunch of little tents and small shacks that operated out there, and there was blaring hand crank phonographs that went night and day, and so you could even hear it sometimes from the actual town site. Areas outside the town site were also in the Chugach National Forest in those days, and foresters often complained that prostitutes were asking for camping permits on the actual forest lands out there. Anchorage was never really truly a boom town because the wages paid by the railroad were not as high as other places in the state. So even though it attracted a lot of workers, we didn't get that huge boom and bust mentality that occurred in other parts of Alaska.
But in terms of the Prohibition days, Anchorage folks got pretty creative. And you, Audrey, you were mentioning to me a story about the Oscar Gill House, and I wonder if you could share that with our listeners.
Well, Oscar and Emma Gill, and I think a number of people are familiar with the Gill House. It's now being run as a bed and breakfast. But in the early years, in the 1920s, Oscar and Emma and their children all lived there. And for a period of time, 1920 to 1923, a couple of uncles also lived with the Gills. Later, in late 1980s, the Lutzes bought the old, abandoned by this time, Oscar Gill House. And when they went to renovate it to be a bed and breakfast here in Anchorage today, they noticed these wide removable windowsills. Well, it turns out during Prohibition times, the bootleggers would come to their various clients' homes, remove from the removable windowsill the empty bottle and replace it with a new one. And that's how they distributed the illegal brew. Now, this is not attributed, I want to be clear, this is attributed to the uncles, not the Gills themselves. Oscar Gill, in fact, when he was 12 years old, had signed one of the Women's Temperance Union pledges to not touch alcohol until he was at least 25.
Interesting. So there's another famous character that I'm aware of is Cornelia Templeton Jewett. Have you heard her name, Audrey?
I have not.
Okay. So Cornelia was actually she came to Alaska in 1909 and was married to Robert Hatcher of Hatcher Pass fame. And Cornelia had campaigned for women's rights and prepared a petition to be sent to Alaska's first territorial legislature for asking for voting rights for women. But she was also a big force in the temperance movement, and her campaign really resulted. So she's also known as, I think, one of the mothers of the temperance movement.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if I could talk just about one more house, because I particularly love this, well, a building, not a house, but it's the Wendler Building, and it's right now on the corner of 4th and D Street, and it's that wonderful old building with a little bit of a turret. That was probably the first business that was built in the new town site of Anchorage back in 1915. And the Wendlers who built that town site had come up from Valdez, where Mr. Wendler was a brewer of alcoholic beverages. And of course, when he brought his family up to the town site, he was going to have to go into a different profession. So he opened up a business in partnership with Ray Larson. So that became a grocery store at first. Over the years, as the years passed, in the late 1948s, many people probably remember Club 25. Well, Myrtle Wendler, the Wendler's daughter, in a manner of speaking, returned the Wendler Building to its roots because she convinced her mother, her father had died by this time, and she convinced her mother that they should open this up as a club for women. Fourth Avenue was a row of bars, but there wasn't a nice place for women to go and have a dinner and some drinks. And Club 25 met that need and is still known today for a really terrific cocktail, the Golden Comet. Some of you may remember it. It was said you should only have one.
So this that was what year?
That would have been in the 1948, I believe,
1948.
That they opened it up.
Okay.
I believe that Audrey has the recipe for that Golden Comet, too.
Oh, wow. Okay. Luckily, we're not drinking those today. So, Bruce, just a little bit more, if you could share with us some of the creative ways or things that were happening in Anchorage during those times. So we're really talking about 1918 to 1933. So in 1933, of course, the Prohibition Act was repealed. So what's going on in Anchorage at the time?
Well, one of the things that tipped the Bone Dry Act, too, into enactment was in 1916 an announcement that 3,820 bottles of whiskey and 814 bottles of beer were seized at Point Campbell, by federal marshals here in the Anchorage area. They were to be sold at public auction in Seward, which was not a dry town. The sale became quite controversial, as a Seward editorial questioned whoever got the idea of taking whiskey from, quote, saintly Anchorage and feeding it to the people of Seward. And this alleged hypocrisy apparently stopped the sale, and Judge Wickersham then proposed that Bone Dry Act in 1917 to Congress. So that was an interesting little tidbit there.
Well, and I also read that in Anchorage, so the Alaska Engineering Commission at the time was tasked with building the Alaska Railroad.
Yes.
And they, unbeknownst to them, they were also tasked to do additional things to build the infrastructure in the town, which included water, sewer, telephone, electric. But one recurring theme was that this became quite a challenge for them as they were battling the evil three, as they became known, alcohol, prostitution, and gambling. So there's another Anchorage character that, Bruce, I heard you talk about earlier, and that's Russian Jack. And so who's Russian Jack? What's going on? How does that character play a role in Anchorage history?
Well, Russian Jack is one of our more colorful people and was probably our best-known bootlegger at the time. There's parks, banks, schools, everything else named after him today. But he was a homesteader that had a homestead out where present-day Russian Jack is located, and did a lot of bootlegging. But he actually, in his initial years, when he first came to Anchorage in 1915, he's a Ukrainian immigrant, not Russian, but he set up a business called the Montana Pool Room. Notice it wasn't a bar in those days because alcohol was forbidden in the town site. And it was a known front for alcohol, of course, as were all the pool halls on 4th Avenue. But for some reason, he lost his business there later years. But for years afterwards, during Prohibition, he could be seen wheeling a baby carriage up and down 4th Avenue with blankets over his illegal booze that he made out in his still. and he was quite known to sell to anybody that asked for it then. It's interesting that law enforcement never really went after Russian Jack, so an interesting tidbit of old Anchorage history there.
Right. So a couple of other tidbits that I found about other places outside of Anchorage in the community of McCarthy. So again, you know, the Bone Dry Law Act has been enacted, and folks are quite aware. And so in the community of McCarthy, engineers on the inbound train actually changed the color of their engine smoke to warn of federal law enforcement on board. So this allowed folks in the community time to clean up. That's really smart, I think. It's really smart before an inspection. So I'm not sure if you, Audrey or Bruce, you ran across any other interesting stories like that of creative ways, like Russian Jack with his baby carriage or the folks in McCarthy with their smoke of doing a nice disappearing act so that it wasn't quite obvious what folks were carrying.
Well, on a more ugly side, you know, law enforcement was stretched pretty thin here in the Anchorage area in particular. There was only U.S. Marshals up until about 1920, and they had a lot more work to do than they could keep up with. But in 1920, the Anchorage Council was formed, and Leopold David became our first mayor. And one of the first things he did was, well, he had a platform of wanting to stamp out the three evils, as we discussed before. But he established the Anchorage Police Department at that point and created the department with John Sturgis as the first police chief. Well, John Sturgis was murdered 2 months after he took office by an unknown assassin, and his own gun was used. Suicide was ruled out, but the actual killers were never apprehended, although alcohol was figured into any of the conspiracy theories that were used at the time. John Sturgis had just shut down 12 illegal stills in the Anchorage area just a month prior to his death. And then after that, the second police chief, a guy by the name of Kitzmeyer was appointed, but he quit about 3 months after that, saying the job was just too dangerous. And then our third police chief, a guy by the name of Harry Cavanaugh, came on the job in 1923, and he was murdered after 8 months on the job by what was described at the time as an alcohol-crazed individual. So the Anchorage Police Department got off to a pretty shaky start there, and alcohol figured into the whole prohibition thing figured into a lot of what was going on in Anchorage at that time.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Shelley Wade, and today we're talking about prohibition in Alaska and the history of alcohol control in our great state. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to share with us or stories, you can reach us in Anchorage at 550-8433, outside of Anchorage at 188-353-5752, or email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So in the research that I did, I came across a couple of more of those interesting tidbits. The Fairbanks Barthel Brewing Company, when they found out that the Bone Dry Law Act was going to be enacted, they bought out the Tanana Bottling Works and began brewing distilled water. I thought, okay, that's pretty creative. But then the thing that I thought was fun that went with that was a poem. And I'm actually, this is from, if you've read Dermot Cole's book on Fairbanks, this poem is in his book. This was a poem written by an outsider regarding the coming of prohibition in Alaska. The sourdough, when he wants a drink, will amble to the Yukon's brink and quaff a horn of H2O, a harmless drink, as well you know. Then go his way in search of gold and sing an ode to water cold. And he makes a stake he'll go to camp and buy a drink or so of orangeade, near beer, or lime, and swear he's had a ripping time. thought that was a fun one, because in Fairbanks, the vote to pass the bone dry law was closer, with 501 residents voting dry and 433 wet. And then there was only one community that actually voted 1210 wet, and that was the community of Chena at the time. So that's a little interesting tidbit. So what else do we know about what's happening in Anchorage at the time in terms of either the bootlegging that was happening or creative ways that people were bringing in alcohol? Or really, when folks found out in 1933 the law had been repealed, how did the attitude change?
Well, I do have a comment about during the Prohibition years. I think the kids in the community the federal agents apparently came up with a bit of money that would be given for any of the bottles that were found or any information about bootleggers. And the kids found out that if they collected empty bottles, they could turn them in and they would get quite a nice little income from the feds. So enterprising young people, and I believe John Bagoy, who headed the John Bagoy Summer Solstice Historic History Tour, I believe he was one of them. Oh. Nice little way to pick up extra dollars when you were a child.
Yeah. Well, he actually talked about that, how he would go around looking for these bottles all over town. And there's quite a group of the young kids that would do that. And they got quite a bit for turning in bootleggers if they found it. But that was dangerous business because the bootleggers didn't take kindly to be turned in by kids.
Right. So.
And it would dry up. It would eliminate the bottles that they were finding and getting money for.
Oh. Yeah. It was a pretty lawless town, and bootlegging and the whole business of alcohol, gambling, and prostitution figured into a lot of what happened in this town in the early days. We had our first double murder in 1923 over a still out in the Eagle River area, where two Finnish immigrants were killed over a dispute over a still. And there's just a lot of history of the crimes that existed here in this town that were connected to the Prohibition years there.
So we're still anxious to get your questions and take your calls regarding Prohibition in Alaska. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Shelley Wade. And again, you can reach us in Anchorage at 550-8433, outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752, or email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So I wanted to go ahead and flash forward here and switch gears and talk about Anchorage or alcohol control today, and think about that statewide and what's happening today. And so, of course, we have in the studio with us Shirley Gifford and Bob Beasley, both of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. And Shirley and Bob, I wanted you folks to tell us a little bit about the role of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, and maybe even kind of put that into some historic perspective. So we've heard a lot from Audrey and Bruce about what was going on prior to the Bone Dry Law Act and what's happening, what happened during Prohibition. So if we flash forward, and I guess maybe even 1980 or prior to that is an important time for us.
Okay, I can go back a little bit further than
Great.
That, and that's to statehood. In 1959, the first Alaska state legislature created a three-member Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. So the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board has been around for quite a while, and that board was appointed by the governor then, as the board is appointed by the governor today. The board eventually extended to five members, and that was in 1970. And it's at five members today. So two members are members of the alcohol industry, and three members are members of the public. And they serve three-year terms that overlap. So that's the history of the ABC board. The board has a staff of 11, including me. And we have an enforcement unit that is made up of one supervisor, who is Bob Beasley, who's here today, mm-hmm. and four investigators. We have one investigator in Fairbanks and one investigator in Juneau, and two investigators in Anchorage. And then we have a licensing unit with one supervisor and two licensing business registration examiners is what they're called. And they assist applicants in applying for any one of 20 different kinds of licenses in the state of Alaska. So we have about 1,800 licenses that are out there across the state. The majority of them are in Anchorage, and then the rest are spread out. And it's all based on population. So a community of 3,000 people, say, could have two restaurant eating place licenses, which is a restaurant, and one of each other kind of license. So it's all based on population, and that's fairly new as well. I think that happened maybe 20 years ago, where it was based on population. So we have quite a few licenses that have been grandfathered in. Some communities where they may be allowed 25 different kinds of licenses may have 48, and it's going to be many, many years before they see any new licenses in those communities. So what happens with that is licenses can become fairly expensive. You might be able to get a beverage dispensary license for $2,500 through the ABC board, but if there are no licenses available, they can go for $250,000.
Wow. So it looks like actually we have a question from Wiley. Wiley, you have a question about the liquor stamp in Territory Alaska. Maybe you should ask the question. I'm not quite sure.
Okay, yeah. Why are we hooked up here?
Yeah, you're on air.
Okay, I acquired here a few years ago. A fella had found a stamp up here in Wasilla, and it's Territory of Alaska, and it's given you okay to have in your possession 3 gallons of whiskey. Do you know anything about them?
Shirley or Bob, does that sound familiar
that
to
does
you?
Not, this is Shirley. That does not sound familiar to me, and I know Bob's kind of shaking his head. So that's yeah. something that sounds to me like that could be a valuable relic.
Is there?
I would hope so. I've got her. And, I don't know where to go with that to find out more information on it.
So I wonder if maybe someone at the Cook Inlet Historical Society would be able to answer that question.
Well, this is Bruce. So what does it say again? Now it says that you can have possession, right?
Yeah, possession of 3 gallons.
Okay, that sounds like that was enacted before the Bone Dry Act went into effect, and there was areas there where you could get, well, going back in the history and everything, there was various laws there that allowed you to possess so much alcohol in the territory. But that would be prior to 1915, it sounds like. Is there any date on that at all?
I don't know. I'm on the road right now. I'll have to look at that. I don't know. I don't think there's a date on it.
Yeah. Because it was strictly prohibited, of course, after the Bone Dry Act went into effect in 1918 until the 30s. And then after the 30s, there was no restrictions statewide on that. It just became a local issue then.
I think
it'd be interesting if I could figure out where to track this down, to see if that stamp might be worthwhile to some collector or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder maybe if someone, too, at the Anchorage Museum would be able to help out. So maybe we can provide those links online. Do you have access to the Internet, Wiley?
I don't have myself, no.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, maybe.
Long without it.
Oh, that's okay. Well, if you want to give us a call back, we could provide you with some contact information, too, for the Anchorage Museum. That's a great question. So thank you so much for your call today. I appreciate it, Wiley.
The same number I got here, this 550?
Yes, that same number.
I'll call you at a later time here.
Okay, thanks, Wiley.
Okay.
So we're going to go ahead and take a quick break. Go ahead and take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hear more from Shirley and Bob from the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Shelley Wade. Mm-hmm.
listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Shelley Wade, and today we are talking about prohibition in Alaska, the history of alcohol control in our great state. And my guests today are Bruce and Audrey Kelly. They're volunteers and members of the Cook Inlet Historical Society, and Shirley Gifford, director for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, and Bob Beasley, enforcement supervisor for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. So right before we took the break, we were hearing from Shirley. Well, we had an interesting call from someone that found a historical stamp that gave an Alaskan the ability to carry, I forget what Wiley said, 3 gallons of alcohol. Yeah, fascinating. But we were also talking with Shirley about the Beverage Control Board and kind of the composition of that board and the history of the board. And Shirley, I had a quick question for you about rural representation on the board. Is that a concern, or how do you guys address that?
It was a concern, and it was brought up before the Alaska State Legislature last year, and a law was enacted where a rural member would be appointed to serve on the board. And it just so happened that at that time that the law was passed, we did in fact have a rural member, and that's Belen Cook, and she's from the city of Cordova.
Okay, so I have a couple more questions for you about kind of rural representation and prohibition in rural villages, but we have Jeff on air right now, and Jeff has a question, and I'm not sure if any of the folks in our studio today can answer this for you, Jeff, but it looks like you have a question on the prohibition of marijuana.
Thank you, Shelley, for taking the call.
Absolutely.
Well, I have 4 points that I would like to do is sort of mention them and then listen to any responses off the air, because it is sort of generic as well as specific. The first point is that with all the huff and puff about health and deteriorating lives and work of the devil and all that stuff, truth is, prohibition was passed for political reasons to get votes, and the hype was what caused the public to vote for it. And I just would like a little bit of a sort of a passing reference to the fact that we are in fact experiencing prohibition, but against a different chemical or a different substance. Interestingly enough, the marijuana prohibition was passed very shortly after the prohibition of alcohol was vetoed, or whatever, you know, the law was
repealed.
I couldn't think of the word, I'm sorry. Okay, so that's my first point. The second point is the same methods of fear-mongering and political vote gathering are being used to support the prohibition of marijuana, despite any objective study will produce a dearth of information that, if you go past the point where human lungs are not intended to inhale smoke any more than human stomachs are intended to ingest, you know, alcohol, after that there is a dearth, a very, very slight scientific evidence supporting the evils of marijuana that are claimed. The third point I want to make out, which is something I think everyone who drives on the road can identify with, Americans simply do not obey laws that we don't like. And if you don't believe me, go on the road and see how drive at the speed limit and see how many people pass you. And the fourth point is, as happened with alcohol, the current prohibition, which I think really serves as at the time in the 30s, served as sort of like job security for that incredible large force that was mobilized against alcohol, what were they going to do? You know, there are just too many people. So there's like an anti-marijuana industry that grows. And as with alcohol prohibition, the prohibiting laws served then and serve now to increase the prices and the cost and the amount of money that is made, and the criminal element gets drawn to it because there's no control if there's law against it. And it's just, this is really a fascinating show, and I don't mean to run you off the track, but the point is that the concept of prohibiting something, which if used appropriately, is not a terrible, terrible, destructive thing. The principle behind prohibiting the alcohol is still being maintained in the current laws of prohibition. And I'm not saying this because I'm a pothead or something. I mean, I'm 70, and trust me, I'm out of that phase. But the point is that there are people who are benefiting in Alaska. Thank God we're one of the states that allow people to get exemption from the prohibition for medical reasons. But rather than babble on, I'd like to kind of stop and then take any response or relevant response off the air. But I especially would love to hear an acknowledgement that prohibition as such has not gone from this country. It simply changed the target.
Well,
and
thank you.
Thank you for being so patient with my long-winded call.
Absolutely, Jeff. Thank you for your comments. So maybe I'll start over with our Alcoholic Beverage Control Board folks. And Shirley or Bob, you guys have any thoughts on Jeff's comments?
This is Shirley. I have quite a few thoughts that are going through my head. I know there are a lot of studies and a lot of research that's been conducted. And I know that marijuana over the years has increased in potency. There have been studies to show unequivocally that it's a gateway drug. And we understand that, you know, the scourge on society with the use of drugs. We also know that alcohol creates a problem in our society as well. And we do have control over alcohol. I mean, we don't control it to the extent that we would like to have control, but, you know, there is the control over alcohol. I don't know where you would ever start with getting rid of the prohibition on drugs. I mean, it's just such a horrible thing that happens to our youth and people who have become so addicted. And, you know, it's hard to measure that kind of an addiction to the alcohol addiction that we deal with. And I just think it's too much for our society to try to handle. You know, I know our social services, social service agencies are maxed out with the types of things that, you know, we try to do. We partner with the Department of Health and Social Services on a couple of different levels. And one is with the enforcement of underage drinking laws and also with the I'm a member of the advisory committee for the Strategic Prevention Framework State Incentive Grant, where Shelley's on that as well. So
in my other life, I'm working
yes.
on that issue. Yeah,
and so we understand because we've been part of that group where so many people are involved at so many different levels, and just trying to figure out how do we protect our youth and how do we help adults who are involved in binge drinking, and how much more can we handle? Can we take drugs on?
Well, and so maybe I'll add to Jeff's comments that kind of connect back to his larger question of prohibition. Does it really work? Well, I think the folks that were alive and well and bootlegging from 1988, that's when I graduated from high school, 1918 to 1933 would say no. And all the research that I did said no, it didn't work. And so I think for folks in Alaska, maybe the question is today in the role that you have in the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, we have wet, damp, and dry villages. And so does the dry village model Does that really work? Are we really prohibiting, is the prohibition of alcohol consumption or selling alcohol, is that really working for us? Mm-hmm. So maybe you can speak to that question a little bit.
Okay. Did you want me to speak to that?
Well, you can or I can.
Okay. I don't want to be a radio hog.
Well, I can just start out by saying that, and this is Bob Easley, the enforcement unit supervisor, that the community of Barrow, for instance, at one time, they were a wet community. This was several years back. They had a local option election and opted to go dry, where they banned alcohol. And
so wet community, can you just tell us really quickly, Bob, wet, damp, and dry, what's the difference?
Well, wet is, you know, for instance, Anchorage is considered wet. We've got, you know, liquor licenses here. You can be a local option community and still be wet. You know, by local option, they could forbid the sale of alcoholic beverages except by certain types of licenses. They could allow for, like, only a package store license or a restaurant eating place license, or those that are owned and operated by the community. So, and then that's your wet community, and then you've got your damp community, where they have banned the sale of alcoholic beverages, but they allow for importation. And you allow for importation, you're allowing for importation and possession. And then you've got your dry, which it's strictly prohibited. So,
okay, that's helpful. So you were saying with Barrow, they've gone back and forth on this.
Right, and right now they're a damp community. They allow importation in the community, but I'm just using them as an example. This is fresh on my mind that I know was a big thing in the law enforcement community, that their statistics on sexual assault-related and domestic violence crimes had dropped dramatically when they went dry. And then when they had voted to go damp again, where they allowed possession, that those statistics began to rise. So, you know, there's some correlation there, yes.
Okay, so do we see that in a number of villages then, or a number of communities, I should say, where there is a correlation between the prohibition or that dry status and a decrease in what are substance abuse related behaviors, it sounds like.
And this is Shirley. It's difficult to really come up with the statistics, but for the communities, because the Alaska State Troopers with their Abade unit deal with the importation of alcohol when it's illegal in these communities. So they're the agency that has the statistics on this, but it's our job to work with the local governing bodies, those communities who want to decide for themselves what's best for their community. The state doesn't come in and dictate, okay, say for instance, community of Akiak, we're going to decide for you that you are going to ban sale and importation. No, the state didn't do that. That community did that because they felt, the majority of the voters felt, that this is what's best for our community. And we have about 107 communities in the state of Alaska who have opted to have a local option. They voted on what they feel would work best for them, and they have a choice between banning sale and importation, sale, importation, and possession, or you can have a municipal license or a specific license. Just recently, I worked with the city of Aleknagik, and they had lodges in their community that would serve alcohol to their visiting guests, or wanted to serve alcohol to their visiting guests, but couldn't do it because prior to the local option law coming into effect, the city of Aleknagik was a dry community. The people there, there are between 200 and 300 people who live there, and opted not to have alcohol. Well, then you have these lodges that come in. They build their beautiful lodges. They expect that people are going to come in. They're going to be able to serve them wine with their dinner. They couldn't do it because this was, in effect, a grandfathered-in local option community. So what they had to do was get a petition. They signed a petition. The members of the community voted on it, and they allowed that specific kind of license, an outdoor recreational lodge license. And so now that just happened last year.
Okay. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the enforcement side. So we know they're with the dry villages. So how many dry villages? And Shirley's looking at a resource that's available on the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board website.
Right. It's under wet and dry communities.
Under wet and dry communities. And there's also a very useful map that I saw.
This is Shirley. We have 34 totally dry communities.
34.
And the other out of the 107 are damp communities.
Okay, great. So if you folks are just calling or just listening, just turning on your radio, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Shelley Wade, your host. And today we are talking about prohibition in Alaska. And right now we're talking with Shirley Giffert and Bob Beasley of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. And I was just about to ask Bob a question about the enforcement side of things. So it sounds like a lot of work. So I was curious about what resources really go into the enforcement side. So, you know, how do you folks work with, say, the Alaska State Troopers or other local law enforcement, like our village public safety officers, VPOs, those folks? How does that work?
We have a pretty good working relationship with all law enforcement throughout the state. You know, a lot of municipal police departments and troopers and VPSOs will come to us with Title IV questions. If you've ever looked at our Title IV statutes, they're somewhat difficult to understand at times, and we can assist with that. We provide training, Title IV alcohol beverage law training to law enforcement agencies. We also provide, you know, one-hour course to licensees if they want to have a little get-together with their employees on Title IV laws. The investigators that we have do the compliance check program throughout the state. We have underage buyers. They're 18 to 20 and a half years old that work for us under contract. We send them into licensed establishments. They use their real identification. They're under 21, but they are young adults. They're 18 to 20 and a half, and they attempt to purchase alcohol. When they do, we take the appropriate action. We also do what's called the shoulder tap program, and we do that in conjunction with other law enforcement agencies who will assist us in that, where our underage buyers, for instance, they'll stand outside of a package store and solicit passersby, you know, that, hey, I'm 18 years old, I'm going to a party, will you get me a couple of 40 ounces of beer or whatever? And then on those, we like to do physical arrests when they furnish these young people with alcohol, and off to jail they get to go. So,
okay, so if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. We're talking about prohibition in Alaska. If you have a comment or question for us, if you're in Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752, or email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So I was also curious, Shirley, you mentioned, you know, the strategic prevention framework, this idea of, you know, getting at substance abuse issues that are related to other behavioral health problems. I'm wondering if you guys are partnering, if the ABC board, if you guys partner with other agencies or entities in the state to either create law or to address alcohol issues. So I'm thinking about like the Department of Health and Social Services or other Alaska for-profit or native nonprofit organizations.
This is Shirley. Yes, we do partner with the Department of Health and Social Services, and one of our investigator positions is funded through an Enforcement of Underage Drinking Laws grant, and so he's fully funded to work that grant, and that's under DHSS. And I also am a member of the Alaska. It's a coalition on the prevention of underage drinking, and that is a committee that looks. It started out with a nationwide effort, and then it went to the state, and then it went to the local communities to figure out what can we do to decrease underage drinking. And so it's taken not just from the angle of, you know, what the ABC board might be doing with their grant. We're just a small part of a small piece of a larger grant. And the schools are involved, and, you know, social services are involved, and clinics, hospitals, you know, the medical field is involved. And it's just a very large group of people coming together to take their piece or their part of that prevention plan. It's a statewide plan to take their part to help in in reducing underage drinking. And part of the SPIFSIG that I talked about earlier, the Strategic Prevention Framework State Incentive Grant, received about $11 million from the federal government. It's a grant, and six communities throughout the state won portions of that grant because they had submitted proposals that would help them to prevent underage drinking and adult binge drinking. And so I think that's, yes, there is a lot of partnership in the state of Alaska to try to attack this whole problem of underage drinking. And you know, I'd like to add that through the efforts of you know, our compliance check program and working with industry members through CHAR, the Cabaret Hotel Restaurateur Association, we work with them as well. And industry is really doing well on those compliance checks. We've got three communities in the state right now, Fairbanks, Juneau, and the Mat-Su Borough, who have reached levels of 93%, 92 and 93% compliance when we're sending our underage persons in to try to purchase alcohol. They're at 93% refusal rate, which is phenomenal. And I don't think that happened accidentally. It happened because people are working together to try to prevent that.
So it takes a lot of collaboration.
It really does.
Private sector, public sector folks working together. Right. So we have Harry online. And Harry, you've got a question about the red stripe law in Alaska. Welcome to Hometown Alaska, Harry.
Thank you. The premise was that prohibition didn't work because the huge majority of people were law-abiding people that didn't abuse alcohol, and that just a few were the ones that caused the problems. And that continues today. You know, there are people that are repeat offenders that continue to get multiple DUIs and beat their wives or beat their husbands or all sorts of domestic violence things. But they're many of the same people over and over again. And the red stripe law targets those people that are causing the real serious problems. Undoubtedly, there are some people that are first-time offenders that cause serious problems as well. But it's targeted at those people that have proven that they can't handle alcohol. And I was wondering if the ABC board could add that to their stings. You know, we have it mandatory in Anchorage now, and hopefully we'll have it mandatory in other areas of the state to target those people that have caused the problem in the past and continue to cause the problem in the future.
Thanks for your question, Harry. Bob, maybe do you want to answer that for us?
I could address that. And thanks, Harry. That's a good question. The alcohol restricted licenses by statute, those are court mandated, and so the individual, when he or she goes to DMV and they get their driver's license or ID card, it's got that alcohol restricted stripe. They're forbidden by law from consuming or purchasing alcohol. Now, a person by state law that has the alcohol restricted license can still go into a licensed premise. They just can't consume or purchase. Now, the municipality of Anchorage passed an ordinance that where they were requiring mandatory ID checks in package stores, and that's a city ordinance, and that's where, you know, they're going to show their ID. They've got the restricted license, and they may opt to kick them out. But the state statute is that they can't purchase or consume.
Right. I know. I'm the one that wrote the law.
Okay.
This is Harry Crawford.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, thanks.
I mean, what I want is more enforcement of what we have. And, you know, the problem with a lot of the communities is they say it's ineffective because it's not being enforced. And we need more enforcement for people to recognize that it can help. There's no telling how many people already that it may have saved the lives of or injuries just because they're, you know, I've forgotten, it was a couple of thousand red stripes in Alaska right now.
This is Shirley, and yes, Mr. Crawford, that was a very valuable tool, and I congratulate you on your success in getting that passed. And I also agree with you that there is more work to be done to make this fully successful, and I think Anchorage is on the right track with that. I would also like to add an anecdote that the program has been so valuable. We had a woman who had gone to DMV and somehow was able to get a red stripe on her own without being court ordered. And I don't think it's going to happen again. I think it's something that just kind of was something that maybe she got a clerk there where that was able to do that, but I think it's set up now. But she so much wanted the assistance of this red stripe license to prevent her from going in, and but she did. She failed at some point and did go in, and that was how we discovered that she had gotten this on her own. But you know, I think it speaks volumes to the program. You know, if people are looking for ways to help themselves and help others, people who have problems with alcohol, they're searching for ways. And I think one of the loopholes with the law right now is that it's really up to the person who's trying to make the purchase. The person who is restricted, it's their responsibility and not the responsibility of the server of alcohol. Like with underage persons, it's the responsibility of the server not to sell to an underage person. It's the responsibility of the person who's restricted not to try to purchase alcohol. And that's one of the things that we run into here, because a person could present a passport. We're just right now, I'm working on a regulation that our board has supported, and that is for written orders to some of the lodges where you're allowed to use a government-issued license from any state or a foreign passport, and you wouldn't be allowed to use a passport from the United States, because we're seeing that. And you know, when the Red Stripe Law came into effect, we were getting calls from people saying, why am I getting more tribal IDs? Why am I getting more military IDs? Why am I getting so many passports right. being shown?
Wow.
And so there's more work to be done. And I think, you know, kudos for the law. And I think that there needs to be more work.
If you could just, when you get a passport or a tribal ID or something like that, if you could require the licensee to send in the information to make sure that person that turned in a passport or some other sort of ID wasn't on the red stripe list, because then that would work just as well.
Unfortunately, Harry, thank you so much for your call. We have covered so much ground today. We've got a lot more to cover, it sounds like. This has been a fantastic and very fascinating hour. Thanks so much to my guests, Audrey and Bruce Kelly of the Cook Inlet Historical Society, Shirley Gifford and Bob Beasley from the Alaska Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Coming up next week on Hometown Alaska, join host Charles Wolforth for discussion on Community Read, a program spreading to libraries across in Anchorage and across the U.S. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Also, make sure to check out our new website, alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Shelley Wade.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.